lot of this was hypothesis generating work, but myself and my colleague, Dr. David Markinson, who's the director of our Disaster Medicine Center, have been working together for several years, and he's a pediatric emergency room physician and a former paramedic, and I, my former life, was also a paramedic. And one of the things that you know, we wanted to know early on was, you know, what could our emergency medical services staff, our EMTs and our paramedics, actually provide a little bit more than emergency response during public health emergencies and disasters? And this is something that we've been, again, looking at for several years. We wanted to discuss things like altered standards of care, using paramedics and EMTs to provide vaccinations, to distribute medications, to staff community, you know, point of dispensing clinics, to you know, perhaps even in the course of their duties, go and deliver medications or other types of treatment or care in a public health emergency to homebound patients and somewhat augment a visiting nurse type capacity, since they do have the ability to provide medical care and are mobile and certainly go into people's homes every day and provide medical care. These all seem to be reasonable things sitting in a conference room, but, you know, like anything else, you sort of have to go out and you have to show some data that this is feasible, is plausible, can be performed, and that is indeed what we've done. So the data that I'm going to talk a little bit about this morning really fits into both of the presentations. First, we're going to talk about sort of the role of emergency medical services in public health emergencies in a broader sense. And then in my second presentation, we're really going to go ahead and we're going to look at the scope of practice of emergency medical technicians and paramedics and see if we can draw some parallels and say, all right, this is what they do every day in an emergency medical setting. How is that going to translate into a pandemic? How is that going to translate into some sort of outbreak or some sort of smallpox event? Or, you know, how are we going to be able to actually utilize them based on their current skills and with some just-in-time training or maybe with even something a little bit more comprehensive? You know, what can we really have them do? What can we expect of them in an emergency? And that's what we hope to look at here. So let's take a journey and take a look and see. All right, again, just some basic introductory concepts again. So the emergency medical services system is one of the key components in disaster, terrorism, and public health emergency response. I think that's fair. The EMS system has certainly developed over the past 30 years into a little bit of, well, nothing really in the early 1970s and late 1960s, into a fairly sophisticated system of assets and resources and training and education and regulatory oversight, and is certainly now a bona fide profession for hundreds of thousands of people in the United States. Well, the interesting thing, and made a lot of sense to us, is, well, gee, the public health agencies, local and state, actually provide regulatory and certification and licensure authority in most states, not all states in the country, but in most states provide oversight. So that seems to be fairly logical that the public health might actually use this asset during a public health emergency. And there have been other studies that, you know, so we've certainly looked at that actually have looked at specifically using EMTs and paramedics to do everything from pediatric childhood vaccinations at firehouses and in other community locations, and actually using them to certainly staff as part of medical reserve corps is one example, but using them to staff point of dispensing clinics. Some recent work out of the Boston area has looked at using emergency medical technicians to staff their own pods for their own family members to increase ability and willingness to report to work during a public health emergency, which makes perfect sense to me. We've been also doing that for hospital workers, having them staff their own pods to provide prophylaxis, vaccination, et cetera, to their own staff and immediate family members so we can actually have a public health workforce show up at work. So, at any rate, so these are sort of our foundations as we approach this. Now, again, our data comes from actually from two places. One is has quite a bit of epidemiological significance, so if I have any epidemiologists in the audience, you'll appreciate the first data set. It's from the LEAD study. The LEAD study stands for the Longitudinal Emergency Medical Technicians Attributes and Demographics Survey. And this is essentially a prospective cohort of all of the nationally registered emergency medical technicians in the United States that was started in 1998. The group, the representative sample of this group of about 205,000 registered, nationally registered emergency medical technicians and paramedics, again, was surveyed in 1998, and they're cross-sectionally surveyed every 2 years at their point of re-registration with the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians. We basically, like any prospective cohort, like NHANES or Nurses' Health or Framingham, you know, as an epidemiologist, you can go ahead and save some money, add some survey questions, and get some data from them. And that's indeed what we did. So a lot of our data, specifically the data from the next presentation, comes from this large survey that we performed in a couple of years ago. The second aspect of the data I looked at, since we are based in the New York City area, I looked at the New York City metropolitan region emergency medical services providers. What we basically did was a randomized sampling of all of the emergency medical services agencies in the seven counties north of New York City. So not New York City proper in the sense of the five boroughs, since, you know, that is a huge urban area and would only provide us a very narrow view in terms of external validity. So we looked at the northern seven counties in the Hudson Valley region, which include the city of Yonkers, the fourth largest state city in New York City, some urban, suburban, and quite a bit of rural areas as you get into the northern New York area. And we specifically asked in that survey, we wanted to know what the EMS providers could actually provide hospitals in terms of assets during a public health emergency for evacuation, for moving to altered care facilities, for rapid decompression, if you understand what I'm saying, in terms of you know, taking people that are in medical surgical beds or acute care beds and getting them out in the wake of an influx of patients into a medical facility. A lot of hospital preparedness staff are hoping that they're going to have ambulances and have these things available in the midst of a disaster and other stuff. We weren't too sure. You know, while we wanted to, we took the show-me-the-money approach. You know, okay, that's a great planning assumption, fabulous, but is it true? You know, are you really going to have EMS agencies that are going to say, you know what, I can't get anybody to staff my ambulances, there's chaos everywhere, we're getting multiple 911 calls, and now we have to send 25 ambulances to the hospital. We didn't know, so we asked, and we got some results. And of course, we did some literature review because that's reasonable. This is just the requisite leads slide. This is, again, just talks a little bit about the longitudinal emergency medical technicians, attributes, and demographic study. It's a fabulous cohort of emergency medical technicians. Any of you that are doing emergency medical services research or emergency medicine research or want to look at emergency medical technicians, this is a fabulous resource, and you can learn more about it if you go to the National Registry's website, nremt.org, and learn all about it. It's a phenomenal resource. Okay, so what did it show? What did we learn about emergency medical technicians in terms of their, well, we looked at a few different things. We looked at, number one, do EMTs and paramedics get any training to do public health stuff? If so, where do they get it? Who's giving it to them? And what are they learning? And then we looked at another piece. Well, regardless of whether or not they're taught it, are they willing to do any public health stuff as part of their job? So let's take a look. This slide represents, based on, again, the larger national survey, the types of training provided by local and state health departments to EMS personnel. And again, the idea was the health department is the regulatory authority, they're the licensing agency, they provide you know, all of the protocols, standards of care, medical oversight, etc. What are they providing EMTs and paramedics? And the answer is not a whole heck of a lot. And when they do, it's usually on something that requires, you know, that has a legal basis. For instance, mandatory infectious disease reporting, child abuse, elder abuse, and those types of things, because they require EMTs and paramedics to be mandatory reporters of those types of things. So those are the required trainings that the law provides. That's what they provide. Very little else. So, and when it is provided, and as you can see by the graph here, the blue bars, the lighter blue bars, represent what the local health departments are providing. The state health departments, which are the real regulatory components here in EMS, provide much, much less. So mandatory infectious disease reporting, a little less than a third, public health emergencies, less than a quarter, suspicious case reportings, and then, of course, we surveyed, you know, chemical, biological, and radiological incidents since, you know, we wanted to look at that also. So not a whole heck of a lot, you know, when you get down to radiological emergencies, only about 6 to 7% of people said they received any training from the health department regarding that. When they are getting training from the health department, when they are getting training on public health topics, where are EMTs and paramedics getting it? And this was interesting because having worked in schools of public health for the past, you know, 6 or 7 years, we thought we were doing a lot of training for EMTs and paramedics. We thought, you know, we were getting our big HRSA grants and, you know, the hospital stuff and our, you know, health department and training healthcare workforce. And actually, schools of public health have less than 1%. Of EMS providers have ever sat in a class offered by a school of public health. So we need to, I guess I need to take a look at what I'm doing for my EMTs and paramedics. But most 40%, more or less, of all EMTs and paramedics said that if they're going to get some public health training, it's just through regular garden variety continuing medical education. You know, something at their local hospital, something, you know, at the, that their medical director is going to throw on, something at their agency that their training officer is going to take. 17% said they'd never had any formal training. Medical schools provide about 1.5%, according to our cohort. Health departments, 2%. And only about 1 in 5 providers said that they even got a public health, they even heard about public health in their initial training as providers. Okay, so what can we learn from these two slides? That, well, emergency medical technicians don't get a lot of public health training, and health departments and schools of public health don't give a lot of public health training. Interesting. When you look at this slide here, what this says to me is that's pretty remarkable, that even though we're not training our EMTs and our paramedics to do any public health functions, over 60% of EMTs and paramedics said, you know what, as a part of my day-to-day activities, I'd be more than happy to do things like disease reporting, symptom cluster recognition and reporting, or even public health education. That even though that they're not well-trained, that they've only had a very sparse kind of spattering of public health knowledge or public health training, or even sat in a room in a public health building, many of the providers said that they'd be more than willing to actually do some of this as part of their job. They realize the need. They realize the fact that they provide a critical service and that they may have something to offer. And I think it makes sense to look at them as a legitimate resource during the planning processes, and specifically when we're trying to, you know, counter problems, as I mentioned earlier, like, you know, reaching our homebound patients or our patients who can't mobilize and get out to mass vaccination clinics or things during public health emergencies. We may want to take a look at them because, you know, one of the assumptions that we made is maybe in the setting of terrorism, maybe in the setting of certain types of disasters, natural and man-made, you know, are our emergency medical technicians and paramedics going to be out on the street doing emergency response and rescue and the things that they're really trained to do? But it's also possible that in the setting of a public health emergency, perhaps a pandemic, perhaps something maybe not as grandiose or not as emergent, that we may simply have people in large numbers referring to clinics, referring to their primary care physicians with febrile illnesses or with flu-like symptoms, or not necessarily calling 911, but still many, many, many hundreds or thousands of people looking for medical care. And perhaps this may be a resource that we can actually look at to help augment our public health workforce, especially since, you know, we're doing a lot of double and triple counting of our resources. You know, we have nurse who's full-time at Hospital A, per diem at Hospital B and C. She joined the Medical Reserve Corps. She's on DMAT. You know what I'm saying? So this, you know, makes some sense. Let's take a look at these resources. All right. What about the little hospital thing that we mentioned, the second half of the data? So again, we did a survey looking at whether or not EMS agencies would actually be able to provide resources to hospitals in terms of evacuation or decompression during any type of emergency. And in terms of despite the staffing levels, that little phrase right there refers to the fact that and once you get north of New York, you get a lot of volunteer-based EMS. You know, and their question is, where the heck am I going to get my staff just on a regular 911 call, never mind during a big disaster. But despite the fact that staffing is up in the air, only 15.1% of the agencies said that they wouldn't be able to provide ambulances to hospitals. That's a weird way to say it, but basically, you know, 84.9% of EMS agencies said, even though I'm not sure where my staff is going to come from, we would be more than happy to send some ambulances to the hospital if we have them available. So that's good. The second bullet, however, says that even though they're willing, only 12% actually have a formal agreement with a healthcare facility, which means that you have a potentially group of resources, but you haven't really, you know, haven't really talked about it with them. You've never planned a contingency with them. You've never put a memorandum of understanding or some sort of agreement together. And those 12.1% of agencies, what types of agencies do you think those are? Are they volunteers? Are they municipal 911 providers? Or are they private for-profit ambulance services? Private for-profit ambulance services. And the reason that they have the agreements is because they provide interfacility transportation and generate revenue. And that's what they do. They transfer people from the hospital to the nursing home back and forth. Of course, they're going to have some ambulances available. And of course, they have something in writing with those healthcare facilities to ensure that they will get the call when the time happens. So we do have you know, something to think about in terms of memorandums of understanding with local resources to make sure that if you do need to decompress or evacuate your hospital, someone's going to arrive. Because although it seems sometimes that there are a lot of those private services, if more than one hospital needs to be evacuated, like Mass General, or, you know, Beth Israel, or Brigham Women's, or, you know, Columbia Presbyterian, where you're talking 1,200 beds, 1,600 beds, you know, 10, 20 ambulances doesn't help you out. Okay. All right, so conclusions. The conclusions are pretty simple. EMS public health partnerships make sense. We as planners or public health officials need to take a strong look at that. We need to engage them in the discussion, involve them, and really look at their assets as a system and see how they can be applied to public health emergencies.